Go ahead and be seated. Good morning. All right, this morning we've got on one case. We've got docket number 51778, Dichter versus Creative Management Services. Are we ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay. We'll go ahead and proceed.
Your Honor, Bob Apple appearing on behalf of the appellant, and I'd like to introduce for the second time my colleague from the California Bar, Kerry L. Dichter, who will be arguing the case today. I'm here to carry his briefcase.
Okay. And Mr. Dichter, did you want to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, I've asked that 5 minutes be reserved.
Okay.
Good morning. I would like to start by noting that no one could be more surprised than I am that I'm back in this court again in this case that modestly set out as simply a case for the recovery for damage to missing or stolen cargo. When I think of this case and what's important for this appeal and the issues that you are deciding here today, what often comes to my mind is the book, The Trial, by Franz Kafka. In this small story, Mr. Kafka tries to paint the most brutal, difficult, horrifying picture of a legal system imaginable. And what he picked for his story was not a legal system that was particularly corrupt or incompetent or otherwise terrible in any one of a number of ways, but what he picked was a legal system in which a point of law was never actually settled. It was a case where one charged with a crime could only be found to be ostensibly innocent and gain an ostensible acquittal, and nevertheless be subject to rearrest on the exact same charges the next day, or even later the same day. And unless there was an adjudication in favor of the state, the all-powerful state, there was never an adjudication that was binding and final in favor of anyone else. And I think that's the overarching issue that you have here today. My esteemed colleague on the other side would certainly like you to focus instead on the General Motors case and choice of law issues and arguments as to what law should apply in this case. And I've argued that in my brief. I argued it in the brief on the first appeal. I've argued it in the brief second appeal. But I'm not here to re-argue that again. And I'm not here to re-argue that again because the first point I mentioned in my brief is the overarching point in the case, and that is, why is there another hearing in this court to determine the exact same issue that was determined by this court 3 years ago?
Tell me why it's the exact same issue. I'm not sure I agree with you.
Well, the issue is stated best in the brief of my opponent at page 14. He says, beginning at line 19, quote, the rule or principle decided by this court in its decision in the former case is that the Nevada Insurance Guarantee Act, NRS 687A, does not apply to this action because it is not a covered claim within the meaning of the Nevada Act. And then in boldface, the next line, the court did not rule whether any other law might be applicable to the action. End quote. In other words, the view of this case the view of this case embraced by the opposition is that this court was essentially asked to answer but a single question. And the question was not, is the judge's order of dismissal to be upheld or overturned? The issue was simply, does this one code section apply to bar this action?
Well, isn't that kind of specifically what we addressed in that last order?
It is specifically addressed by that determination. But in so doing...
Within the confines of the context of a covered claim.
In so doing, this court had to decide not just the meaning of that Nevada statute, but whether under any contention, under any argument, under any citation of authority, under any view of the case, could the district court judge's order of dismissal be upheld? That was what this court was called upon to decide. And if this court thought that there was any reason, not the reason given by the district court judge herself, but any reason that was sustainable in law, why that order of dismissal should be upheld, it should then have been upheld. This court found no reason for upholding it, and this court's decision, although it discusses a particular Nevada statute, was made in that context, the context that an appellate court does not concern itself with the reasons for a dismissal or judgment in the court below, but rather with whether or not that decision is correct. And I've cited many cases in this court itself for that proposition, which is basic to the functioning of the American judicial system. A litigant is not entitled to come to court piecemeal and urge serially one statute, then another statute, then a third statute on successive appeals as to the exact same issue. That is the profile of a vexatious litigant.
Mr. Dichter, if I could interrupt you. I didn't sit on the panel where the prior case was decided, but in looking at the briefs, it looks like the only one who ever talked about anything else besides the Nevada statute was Amici. You didn't, the other side didn't. So if Amici didn't raise the, if they hadn't raised it, no one would have talked about choice of law or the Missouri statute. True?
I don't think that is true. Of course, I did address it because this court gave me leave to respond to the amicus brief, which I did. And as you note, the amicus brief was all about choice of law from top to bottom. The amicus brief cited to the record before the court and indicated that it was clear from the record that the
But isn't it also true that in the court below, in the first action, that court didn't address choice of law or the Missouri statute either?
That is true.
So what you're suggesting is that that panel decided this issue, the Missouri issue and the choice of law issue, even though the trial court hadn't discussed it. That's what you're advocating here today?
That's what I'm advocating. I'm advocating
okay, on
that
the off chance that the panel thinks differently, why don't you argue the choice of law issue here?
Well, I would do that, but allow me, please, to complete my thought okay. on this basic issue. There may be, aside from choice of law, yet other reasons why the district court's order could have been upheld or denied by this court. When this court made its order, and remember, this order was without a remand for the district court to consider choice of law, for example. Which
but it was an unqualified reversal and remand.
It was.
It was unqualified. It remanded it back.
It was.
And if there were other defenses to bring, they would be brought. For example, let's say that there had been a statute of limitations issue. That order, unqualified mandate, reversing and remanding the case, would not have interdicted that defense on remand?
Yes. If a second summary judgment motion had thereafter been brought based on a statute of limitations, that would have been an entirely new issue that had not been addressed, had not been briefed. And you're correct. But that is not our situation. The second motion that was brought was exactly on the issue of the insolvent insurer, and the record in the first action showed that insurer to be a Missouri insurer, the defendant to be a Missouri company, and there was nothing new in the renewed motion for summary judgment that raised a separate and distinct issue. It was simply a rebriefing of what had already been before the court in the first instance. Now, the choice...
Would you agree that if the Missouri statute applies, your claim can't succeed?
Yes. Yes. That it was actually that this court had overlooked the fact that the Missouri statute should apply when it analyzed the applicability of the Nevada statute. And it was contended even by the district court below that this court had somehow decided that Nevada law didn't apply to this case at all. But that
because
the court
it wasn't
left open.
A covered claim. That's what the court focused on, and that's what was raised.
But there's a difference, Your Honor, between saying that the law of this state does not apply to the case and saying that this statute does not bar this claim. The law was applied to the case, but the statute didn't bar the claim from being prosecuted. Nowhere in the opinion of this court on the first appeal did the court say Nevada law has nothing to do with this case. That would have been a choice of law determination. And that didn't happen. That was urged, as I say, but it didn't happen.
You're at 439. Did you want to reserve that or keep going?
I will reserve, thank you.
Okay. All right, Mr. Rosenberger.
Good morning. I'm here on behalf of Creative Management by and through the Missouri Property and Casualty Guarantee Association. Those are my clients. Very interesting that Mr. Dichter would bring up a work of fiction when he started his argument this morning, because I was going to say the same thing. If we go along with what Mr. Dichter has to say here today, we're in a magical place at a magical time where he can do something in Nevada, in our courts, that he can't do anywhere else in the United States, and that is represent a solvent insurer and seek subrogation from either the insured of an insolvent insurer. And that's what he's trying to do. The facts in this case are very simple, and they're really not an issue. What we have is a solvent insurer, Mr. Dichter's client, bringing a subrogation action against the insured of an insolvent insurer. The insured is domiciled in Missouri, and that fact is important because it really wasn't in the record in the first place. The insurer, Reliance Insurance, is not a Missouri insurer. It's actually a creature of Pennsylvania. That fact was in the initial record. Now, the Guarantee Association throughout the United States, each state has their own association. They've set up a uniform type act that are enacted in slightly different ways all around the country to protect people who have insurance companies that become insolvent. And one of the fundamental uniform rules in those guarantee associations is that they are there for the benefit of the innocent claimant or the innocent insured whose carrier no longer exists to protect them. They're not there to protect solvent insurers from losses that they pay to their insureds. And that's the whole thing we're here to do today. This court, in its initial decision back 3 years ago, made a specific ruling. And the ruling was based on what is a covered claim within the meaning of the Nevada statute, and was this a covered claim to invoke the Nevada Insurance Guarantee Act. And this court made a very specific ruling. I think, Justice Perger, you brought that out. It says, NRS 687A.095 does not bar CPCI's action against Creative. Accordingly, we order the judgment of the district court reversed and remand this matter for further proceedings consistent with this order. There's nothing about this order that mentions Missouri law. There's nothing about this order that required this court to say yes or no about Missouri law. It's not something that was necessary to the decision of this court. This court made a very narrow ruling that the Nevada Act does not bar this action. On remand, we brought it back to the court. We raised the issue of choice of law. Now, Mr. Dichter would say, well, you can't have Missouri law, therefore nobody's law applies. That's what he wants, is nobody's law applies to this case, therefore I can bring it in this circumstance, in this magical place, at a magical time, because this is the circumstance. That just can't be the case. If the court did exactly what you instructed the court to do, the court determined what is the residence of the insured, and then determined it was a covered claim within the meaning of the Missouri law, and then applied the Missouri law and barred the claim. Now, if we accept Mr. Dichter's argument, then we'll be in a situation where, what if we have a case where the district court says, I'm going to apply the law of, say, Utah, and someone appeals and says, no, you shouldn't have applied Utah law. It should really have been Nevada law. So if this court were to decide, no, Utah law does not apply, then we go back to the district court. Is the district court then barred from saying, actually, Nevada law applies? If we agree with Mr. Dichter, the district court can never make the correct decision, even after this court has ruled. If we go along with Mr. Dichter, we're going to have a place where there's no law that applies. And my clients suggest that Nevada would then become a mecca for subrogation in these kinds of cases.
Mr. Rosenberger, assuming for the moment that the district court was free after this remand to exercise a choice of law analysis.
Yes.
One of the questions is, did the court properly analyze the choice of law issue here? You've analyzed it in the brief on the basis that it's a tort claim and look to General Motors.
Yes.
Should a subrogation claim be analyzed differently for choice of law? The subrogation claim itself rests on an assignment, not the underlying tort claim against the tortfeasor.
I don't think it should be. I don't think it should be. You can go through each one of the factors, which was argued in my brief at the district court as well. Each one of the factors really counsels in favor of protecting the insured of the insolvent insurer and by applying Missouri law. I don't know that those factors would apply any differently if you had a you're saying, should it be analyzed like a contract-based claim?
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to get a handle on whether a subrogation claim, the right to bring the claim,
right,
should be evaluated differently than the choice of law question for the underlying claim, which is a tort claim.
I really don't think it should be, because if we were to try this case, the trial is going to be about what did my clients do in regard to these boxes with the watches in them. And it would essentially be a case involving a tort, whether it's conversion or breach of contract. Well, it could be a breach of contract.
But
your argument is that because the defense here is a defense to a tort claim, that's why it should be evaluated under General Motors as a tort defense.
I think so. I think so. That would be my position.
In subrogation cases, other kinds of subrogation cases, what would be the evaluation? Wouldn't it be a contract-based evaluation?
I think you would look at the true... Certainly there's an assignment, which would be a contract-based item. But the underlying case itself, say if it's an automobile case, Farmers pays its insured for damage to his vehicle or for uninsured motorist coverage and then subrogates against the tortfeasor, it's still a tort-based claim. I think you look at the basis of the claim. It's not really a contract claim against
that person. What you're saying here is that the defense at play is in existence because the claim is a tort-based claim.
I think so.
Rather than a defense to who can bring the claim.
I believe that's true. That's the way I would analyze it.
But But I have a follow-up question. The Nevada law would govern the duty and breach and so forth associated with how these goods were handled by your client in Nevada.
Yes.
So tell me how you get to Missouri for the capacity to bring the claim when all the other, if indeed this is a pure tort claim.
I see what you're saying. I think they're separable. I think they should be separable. Otherwise, you're going to have an unjust result that wouldn't be anticipated by any state statute. You have to be able to raise the Guarantee Act statute for the state that is the domicile of the defendant. You have to be able to do that. Otherwise, the system wouldn't work. The national system has been set up.
I'm not suggesting that the result is different. It's just the how you get there, whether it's evaluated on the basis of a different choice of law analysis than a tort choice of law analysis under General Motors.
I see the distinction that you are making, and you know, I don't know.
You know, the difficulty at this area is how the panel approaches the choice of law analysis. Now, this of course assumes, as Mr. Dichter has argued, that it wasn't already decided. But assuming that it wasn't decided, that the question of choice of law is open, the analytics are kind of important.
I still think that if you look at the General Motors analysis, each one of those points...
you're just saying a significant relationship analysis,
right,
would apply in either circumstance.
Think so.
And here's another question. Neither Nevada nor Missouri law is in conflict. They both yield the same result, which is incapacity to bring this suit, correct?
Correct.
And you don't typically have a choice of law dispute unless there's a conflict of laws.
If the Nevada law does not apply, then, and the Missouri law does apply, you're talking about the content being in conflict or a conflict?
There doesn't seem to be any conflict. They're both saying the same thing, which is the insured of an insolvent insurer should not have to pay another solvent insurer.
Correct.
I mean, that's the principle.
But I think the conflict would be that the Nevada law does not apply according to your prior ruling, and we believe that the Missouri law does apply. That's a conflict.
What you're saying is the law of the case, at least in this circumstance, is that Nevada law doesn't apply.
That's the law.
Justice Pickering's question is more fundamental. Where the laws are the same, you don't go through a conflict of law analysis.
But that returns.
So then, do we end up with the result then that Nevada does become the subrogation mecca of the United States?
Well, there's lots of possible results, but one might be that it's already been decided by the prior panel.
I don't think there's
no conflict.
Yes, I don't think it was decided by the prior panel. That would be my position.
Yeah. Okay.
Is that is the law of the case? It was remanded generally, as Justice Pickering pointed out. We raised what we believe is the correct law, and it should be barred. It would be barred in every other state in the United States. It should be barred here.
Could you address the one issue? You've got about 2.5 minutes left on the affirmative defense issue, whether or not this should have been pled as an affirmative defense, and whether or not it was adequately pled.
Well, I didn't file the answer. I'm new counsel in this matter. I was hired after the first appeal. Obviously, the only response to that could be that we have pretty vague rules, not vague rules, but lax rules with regard to notice pleading in Nevada. The argument,
pretty specific with regard to affirmative defenses, though.
Affirmative defense of a statute, whether you have to plead someone else's statute, another state statute, is that the question?
Any affirmative defense. Do you think... the choice of law issue was adequately pled as a
When the answer was filed, it was not even considered by prior counsel. That's why it wasn't argued on the first appeal. And perhaps I should have amended the answer and submitted the choice of law issue that way. Amendment can be granted at any time. I suppose I could request from the court even now to...
Well, my understanding of the affirmative defense is that it said... it recited the Nevada statute, and then it went on to say other applicable statutes or words to that effect. The question would be whether that additional language is sufficient to assert an affirmative defense under Richardson to encompass the Missouri statute.
Arguably, it was, again, prior counsel did that. I don't think anybody after the initial argument and decision in this case, I don't think anybody would be surprised that we would raise the issue of the Missouri statute because it was contained in the amici brief, as you pointed out, at the prior appeal. If there was any prejudice shown to the other side, surprise or anything like that, I should think that would make a difference. But in terms of amendments can be granted at any time. I suppose I could move to amend it now if this court felt that that was necessary. I think it's a technical point that does not necessarily override the underlying concepts that we're raising in this case. I think the law is very clear that this case should be barred. It would be barred in every state. It should be barred here. It shouldn't be a magical place and a magical time for Mr. Dichter's client. And I thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Rosenberg. All right, Mr. Dichter, you got about 4.5 minutes left.
Thank you. First of all, it's incorrect to say that both Missouri and Nevada would bar this claim. We were here on the first appeal to determine whether Nevada did bar the claim. They gave their best shot. Nevada law is substantively different than Missouri law, which is why they have reached, why NIGAR reached in its amicus brief, and counsel for defendant now reaches to apply Missouri law, because we found nothing in Nevada law that would bar this claim from going forward. On the issue of the General Motors case and the application of those criteria set forth, in a tort case such as this, no real case is made for application of another state's laws. You'll notice that among the criteria set out, there's nothing about the insurer, insolvent or otherwise, of any of the parties having any bearing on choice of law. Simply absent from the decision. It's not mentioned in any of the criteria. All the criteria focus on the things you would expect for a tort case. Where does the injury occur? What's the relationship between the parties who met at this place? What is the place of business of any of the parties? The traditional quantitative and qualitative inquiries that relate to choice of law that would suggest that Nevada's own interest in making sure that in the course of its multi-million dollar convention business, there is an orderly compensation for injuries suffered is, if we think, paramount under a General Motors test. But let me go back to the point that I think counsel too glibly covers, and that is the binding effect of this court's prior determination. An order or judgment in this court is not reviewed to determine the reasons given for it and what the court thinks of those. It's reviewed to determine whether it's correct. It said in Birth Mother versus Adoptive Parents in 2002 at 118 Nevada 962, an order correctly granting a motion but for the wrong reasons is affirmed on appeal, and an order correctly denying a motion but again for the wrong reasons will also be affirmed on appeal. So I don't see how you can get from there to the point where we have an order come before this court previously as to whether this claim, a subrogation claim, should be allowed to proceed in the Nevada courts, and that determination of the district court to bar the claim is overturned. It seems to me that on this basic principle of appellate review, it's overturned on every basis that could have been urged, not on the basis of statute of limitations, not on the basis of some completely different circumstance.
So you're saying on all bases that the court hadn't even considered when it entertained the appeal, or that hadn't been presented in the district court in the first instance?
Whether or not presented in the district court. Because to require that an argument be presented in the district court is to lock the hands of the appeals court so that you are guaranteeing a piecemeal appellate litigation. Then it can be said that, well, this is a new reason that wasn't urged on that appeal, and therefore the case that was decided is meaningless, even though it's on all fours.
Well, but there's a more benign interpretation, which is this was a reversal of a summary judgment on the prior appeal, not something after trial or reversal and direction to enter a judgment. It was just saying summary judgment was inappropriate on the basis of NRS 6, whatever it was, whatever the statute was. Therefore, we're reversing and remanding. That happens all the time, and it was an unconditional reversal. Could you address that?
It was an unconditional reversal, and it's correct that it was a summary judgment. But nonetheless, this second appeal is a summary judgment as well, and carries no new or different element of fact with it. These are all arguments based on the face of the pleadings and the admissions of the parties and the stipulation as to the domicile of the parties. So you've got two separate appellate hearings on the exact same point of law. It's not a different point of law. They're just different arguments being urged to settle that point of law. And I just don't see how one can tolerate the inefficiency and unfairness that will necessarily result from permitting that kind of piecemeal determination.
Thank you, Mr. Dichter.
Thank you.
Mr. Rosenberg, we appreciate the submission of your well-done briefs, and this matter will stand submitted. The court will stand in recess.
All rise.
Thank you.